Hi, friends. Welcome to another episode of That Sounds Fun. I'm your host, Annie F. Downs. I'm so happy to be here with you today. Listen, I hear you. You loved that Harry Connick Jr. episode from Monday. Me too. If you have not listened, you got to go back. But today we've got a great show in store for you as well. Before we jump into the conversation today, I want to take a quick moment to tell you about one of our incredible partners, Enneapath, from Your Enneagram Coach. You may remember Beth McCord, Your Enneagram Coach, from her time on Ennea Summer 2019. Well, Beth and her team are starting a new membership site called Enneapath that I think you're going to find really helpful. Enneapath is your pathway to clarity, connection, and growth. And as a member, you'll learn how to use the Enneagram, the Christian gospel, and this innovative new approach to using the Enneagram called the Enneagram Internal Profile as your lens to better understand yourself. Using these tools, you'll learn more about the core motivations behind your personality, explore how to use that information to cultivate your most important relationships, and become the healthiest, best version of yourself. Each month, members get access to a new level of core training, a live Q&A with Beth and her husband Jeff and other certified Enneagram coaches, a supportive community of Enneapath members to connect with, and a monthly community challenge that really puts your learning into practice so you can continue to grow, and exclusive member-only pricing on Enneagram coaching sessions and training programs. This membership is the answer to the common question around here that you guys say to me, I have sorted out my Enneagram type, but now what do I do? So to become a member of Enneapath, just go to yourenneapath.com. That's YOURENNEAPATH.com. You guys, it's only $14.99 per month to join or $9.99 per month for founding members who join this week, the week of April 19th. You can cancel anytime risk-free and there's a 30-day money-back guarantee. So visit yourenneapath.com today. Our guest today is a voice that many of us have absolutely grown to love and respect and need in our prayer time and our daily time. Doug McKelvey wrote Every Moment Holy, which is a collection of liturgies, and now just released is Every Moment Holy, Volume 2, Death, Grief, and Hope. I think you guys are going to love this conversation and these books. If you do not have Every Moment Holy or Every Moment Holy, Volume 2, you've got to get them, you guys. So here is my conversation with Doug McKelvey. Thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you, Annie.
I am so grateful to have you here. This is really fun. We've never met in real life. So
right.
This is the birth of our friendship right here.
Yeah, I feel like it's been a long time coming.
Agreed. Thank you. Yes. So will you back us up to the first Every Moment Holy? Why did you even do this? Why is this what you wanted to put your time and effort to?
Well, it was an idea that kind of formed on its own and arrived almost as a complete idea.
I had
played around over the years with writing poetry with a liturgical structure, mm-hmm. but there was one day when I had been working on a novel for over a year and was just feeling frustrated with myself mm-hmm. because I can very easily get distracted. I sit down in the morning with the best of intentions to start writing. And, right. you know, 4 hours later, I've checked a lot of emails and answered a few of them and caught up on the news. And,
right.
you know, and then it's like, I just feel like a failure at that point. So one day when during a time of particular struggle over a period of a couple of weeks where I just wasn't making much progress, one morning I thought, I really need something that will focus me, a prayer that I could pray every morning when I sit down to write that would reorient my heart and mind mm-hmm. in relation to my Creator and to the stewardship of whatever talents and gifts I have that I'm trying to use as a writer, and in relation to the people that I'm hoping to serve by
sure.
what I'm writing,
yeah.
that I just kind of instinctively realized I need that kind of reorientation on a regular basis mm-hmm. to prevent, you know, myself just kind of losing momentum and doing whatever is easiest mm-hmm. and least productive for the most part. So I thought, okay, I'm going to write a prayer specifically about writing fiction.
Yeah.
And I thought, why not do it with a liturgical structure, just because the poet in me sometimes likes a sort of a challenge and a structure.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's just to add that extra level to the creative process. And so I spent a few hours that day writing a liturgy for fiction writers. Mm-hmm. There's a conference that the Rabbit Room does every
year.
Rabbit Room is a nonprofit organization, and their publishing wing has published both of the Every Moment Holy volumes. And every year they do a conference called Hutchmoot.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to speak at that conference. I was doing a session with Andrew Peterson, and it was about storytelling. So I thought, maybe this would be an interesting way for us to close the session by, you know, passing out copies of this thing. So I sent it to him and said, hey, would this be a good way to close the session? And he responded really quickly and said, I love this, but man, I wish I had a liturgy for beekeeping.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he said one for gardening, and he rattled off several. And in that moment, it's like the idea just expanded in my head, where I realized, this probably isn't just a one-off novelty
mm-hmm.
thing. There's something here that could probably really serve the church to create a book of liturgical prayers that the idea with each one is that it unpacks what it means that every moment is lived under the gaze of God, and that each moment of our lives is something that He desires to use, that He's using it somehow to woo our hearts, to shape us more into the image of His Son, to advance His kingdom through us. And, you know, it's one thing to say that theoretically, but to actually try to unpack, okay, I have to change this, you know, fifth diaper of the day.
Yes. The diaper changing one is talked about constantly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. How does this moment actually touch on eternity?
Mm.
What is the eternal significance of it? What does that look like? Because I think there's a, you know, theoretically, we can say things like, you know, every moment is lived under the gaze of God, and, you know, it's all being used for His purposes, and all things are working together for our good. But when you're changing the diaper or fixing the water heater in the house, what does that actually mean?
Mm-hmm.
So writing the book became for me an exercise in looking at these different parts of life and trying to unpack that, to say, okay, I do completely believe that there is eternal significance to this moment, but on the surface, I'm not seeing it. So, so what's underneath it? What can, you know, what's going on here? So, so it was that moment when Andrew kind of expanded the idea by just expressing his desire to have prayers for other parts of life, that within a few days I had written a few more, including the beekeeping one.
Uh-huh.
I had put together a proposal and took it to Rabbit Room Press.
Oh my gosh.
So, yeah.
So as soon as you had the idea, you had the whole idea and you were going.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. What about the novel? Did you just have to shelve it for a little bit?
No. Well, because actually what happened was Rabbit Room Press said, yes, we want to do this, but we're a tiny little press, and a book like this, we want to do it right,
mm-hmm.
and we don't have the money for it, so you're going to have to give us some time to figure out how we could finance this. And that took about a year before they were able to give the green light on it. Yeah, so that novel probably still needs one more edit. It kept mm-hmm. expanding. It's the one novel is probably three novels now.
Oh my gosh. That is how you Rabbit Room people do it. That is how it goes. So in your faith life, was liturgy and church calendar stuff, was that like kind of already, is that the kind of church you go to? Is that, was that already built in you, or did you kind of have to go, the rhythm of writing this feels like something the church should do or is doing? Was it natural to you?
I did not grow up with any kind of liturgical church background. And I do think it's helpful to define terms, because the word liturgy can be used in very different ways. And in one sense, I mean, it's true to say that every church has liturgy.
Yes.
Right? Because
that's a good point.
Because it just means the form and content of the worship service. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's one meaning of the word. So, I mean, there are churches like Anglican or Episcopal or Catholic or Orthodox that we tend to look at as churches that might have this very formal liturgical structure where, you know, they might be saying prayers and following forms of services that have been developed over hundreds of years. You know, the church where the people just show up on Sunday morning and there's no sermon prepared and, you know, no order. And what they do is someone just spontaneously stands up and starts singing a song and everyone joins in. You know, that also is a liturgy. So but I grew up in actually a variety of churches. Some were non-denominational, some were denominational, but not much liturgy other than maybe some responsive readings, mm-hmm. if we use liturgy in that, you know, more narrow definition of that it's sometimes thought of in. So when I started working on the book, I had been attending an Anglican church for several years. Mm-hmm. I had been introduced to liturgy through the Book of Common Prayer.
Yes.
Around the time that I was in college, and was intrigued by it for a couple of reasons.
Where'd you go to college?
I don't think we want to get into
that. Fine. Keep going. Book of Common Prayer happens in college.
I went to a college where, at the time that I went there, which is probably the only time I can speak to, it was a Christian college, but the theology was way wacky.
Okay.
At the time. I know people who have gone there more recently than I did, years later, and a lot of things had changed.
Sure.
And their experience seemed to be very different from mine.
Sure.
But mine was just 4 years of shaking my head at the things that were said in chapels. So, but the background that I had come from, and the school I was in, I was really wrestling with I knew that there were a lot of things that were wrong that I had been taught in my life, but I didn't know what was right. I didn't have, I didn't have a scriptural foundation that was holistic and overarching and coherent that made sense. And so, you know, I knew that there were things that were wrong, but I didn't know what to replace them with. I didn't know what was right.
Wow.
But it was during that time that I encountered the Book of Common Prayer for the first time. And there was something there that I immediately latched onto because in contrast to the errant theology that was being taught around me and, you know, that was the only thing that I was hearing, I knew that there was something here I could trust in the Book of Common Prayer that I didn't have to be on my guard in the same way.
Wow.
Because these were words that had been formed, again, in some cases over hundreds of years, and that generations of believers had borne witness to, had put their stamp on to say, this is expression of scriptural truth.
Yes.
And so there was something that was refreshing that I didn't have to be on my guard against.
Mm.
But there was also the poetic aspect, right? There was a sensitivity to the rhythm and cadence of words, which is, you know, sort of one of my love languages.
Yes, mine too.
So that marriage of the two things where there was this artistry and this concern for that, that was another thing that had been missing in my theological upbringing was any understanding of how the aesthetic itself has meaning,
mm-hmm.
right? I think it was Marshall McLuhan who said the medium is the message. Mm. And I think there's a degree to which that's true.
Yes.
When people were spending generations building magnificent cathedrals, I mean, there might have been times when it was just an ostentatious display, but I think it was more often this understanding that the space we're creating mm-hmm. for people to worship in does have an effect on yes. on the heart and on the thoughts and the mind, and that, you know, the aesthetic, the beauty matters, mm-hmm. that we're wanting to craft something that stirs the awe and the wonder, and that gives a sense of the holiness. And it doesn't mean that God can't show up in a little tin rusting building,
sure.
just as much. But, you know, there's something, we're created with hearts that respond to these echoes and intimations of eternity that we were created for.
Hey friends, just taking a short break from this conversation to give a shout out to our amazing partners, KiwiCo. KiwiCo believes in the power of kids and that small lessons today can mean big world-changing ideas tomorrow. So they want to kickstart curiosity, creation, and innovation in kids right here, right now. With a KiwiCo subscription, your child gets a new crate full of fun science and art projects every month. I recently got to gift a crate to a mini BFF who's recovering from a broken leg. It's this little felt succulent garden that was a fun creative outlet for them and a little rescue from boredom and screens. And it ended up so cute that I would totally proudly display it in my own house. One of the many things I love about KiwiCo is that they do all the legwork for you so you can spend more quality time tackling projects together. Everything is shipped right to your door and there's no commitment, so you can pause or cancel anytime. But truly, the best part is seeing their confidence grow as they learn, create, and have a great time doing it. There's no telling what a KiwiCo kid can do. Kickstart curiosity, creation, and innovation in kids today and discover a brighter tomorrow. Get 30% off your first month, plus free shipping on any crate line with the code That Sounds Fun at KiwiCo.com. That's 30% off your first month at KiwiCo.com. Promo code That Sounds Fun. And now back to our conversation. I'll tell you what people are loving that are listening that have been friends with me for a bit is my last book, not the one That Sounds Fun that just came out, but before that, Remember God, is about cathedrals and about how moving it is to have a place to remember God and how much it matters. I had a wildly Pentecostal female preacher yesterday tell me that she is dependent on the Book of Common Prayer. So how is it that all of us that stretch across our faith from Catholic to wildly Pentecostal and everybody in between, and I'm not even sure that's a line, but you know what I mean, like all sorts of different branches, we actually really do feel safe in prayers that are written down. Why is that? What is it about that makes us, like you said, feel like we can like kind of take a deep breath? What is it about that makes people feel safe in the written word of prayers?
There was a time in my life, I mean, certainly when I was a teenager, that I would have looked very suspiciously at the idea of pre-written prayers, at things that were not spontaneous. And I've been asked questions along those lines enough in relation to Every Moment Holy to know that there are significant numbers of people who are coming from that perspective, where there's this idea that if something is pre-written, that it can't be spirit-led.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
And, you know, I completely understand where those people are coming from. I don't just dismiss their concerns out of hand, because there was a time in my life when I was completely there. But the way I look at it now is that, you know, I mean, if we start with the idea of Scripture, it comes to us pre-written,
yes.
you know, and I know that people will say, well, but that's a different category. You know, that's...
Yes, no one is thinking you're comparing your writing to scripture.
Right, I hope not.
Right, nor mine. Agreed.
But, you know, the people who have that question don't seem to have the same question with the worship songs that they sing in church. Mm. That, you know, here is this pre-written song that someone else took the time to, you know, to go through the process of trying to articulate the hearts of those who would approach God in worship together. And I think that's a probably a helpful analogy to make for people, because then they can kind of go, oh, yeah, I guess I do trust that the Spirit of God could be at work through the creation process of something that would then enable others to articulate what's on their heart. Yeah. And with the idea of pre-written prayers, it's very much the same thing. Mm-hmm. It's that someone is hopefully prayerfully wrestling through the process of unpacking what would be on the heart of a person who's going through a particular thing or celebrating a particular thing, and recognizing that there is no such limitation on the work of the Holy Spirit, that the Spirit of God can't be and wouldn't be pleased to be at work in the creation process of things that would serve the body of Christ. So to your question of why so many people do, across a wide spectrum of denominations and faith backgrounds, do trust written prayers, I think it goes back to what I said earlier, that first, in many cases, like with the Book of Common Prayer, it is something that bears the, you know, the stamp of approval of generations of believers within the church.
That's right.
And it has been refined. It has been argued over. It has been nuanced and edited, you know, into something that, you know, when you hear a preacher that you're not familiar with, you kind of have to be on your guard a little bit, you know, evaluating in the moment what's going on here. Is is this true? And it's not that we don't also evaluate the truth versus scripture of things that are in writing, but it's actually much easier to do that, I think, with things that are in writing as well. And then once you've been introduced to a prayer, then that's in writing, and you've kind of come to the conclusion that, okay, this is expressing things that are true. It's not contradicting scripture, and it's something that there's something in the way it's phrased that my own heart responds to, that I can enter into this and speak these words
like a worship song.
Yeah, from my own heart. So I think there's just that trust factor that can come with it, because it's not going to surprise you.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
It's not, once you've made that determination that this is true and something that my heart connects with, then you can go back to it again and again and pray it over and over anytime it's appropriate to your situation, and not have to be on your guard.
Yes. The Book of Common Prayer, as you said, has lasted for generations, and people have, I mean, I think my grandparents had a copy that my mom still has. Is that kind of what you hope happens with Every Moment Holy? Do you see it as something that can get passed from generation to generation?
One of the reasons that I went to Rabbit Room and didn't even consider pitching the idea anywhere else for the Every Moment Holy books was because their vision for something like this is very much the same as mine.
Yes.
And that is, you know, I mean, we don't have any way of controlling what happens 100 years from now, but we want to create things with the idea that they might last.
Yeah.
And
that's beautiful.
And we hope to leave artifacts behind us that could continue to speak to and mm-hmm. shepherd people 100 years after we're gone.
Yeah.
You know, in the same way that, I mean, there are so many writers and thinkers that have shaped my thinking, and most of them were gone before I was ever born.
Right.
You know? So there's this idea of stewardship and service to the body of Christ
yeah.
that, you know, I think part of it is recognizing that the body of Christ is not just about this moment in time mm. and this place geographically.
Right.
Right. But we really are a part of something that began thousands of years ago and is going to extend beyond us. Mm-hmm. And all of those people, past, present, and future, who were lovers of God and followers of Jesus, are part of us.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And so the idea that we might be able to create some things that would continue to serve mm-hmm. beyond our very brief span of life is, you know, that's something that that a few years ago, when I was going through a time of a lot of introspection and mm-hmm. trying to sort through, you know, after several things that I had done vocationally had kind of fallen by the wayside for various reasons. And I was looking at, okay, if I maybe can't pay the bills doing creative work, what sort of creative work do I want to do? Mm. Because I'm going to keep doing it.
Right.
You know, but what's my reason? And it really came down to that, okay, you know, I have, you know, maybe 3-4 decades left, or maybe 5 years or a year, I don't know.
Yeah.
But, you know, at best, just a few decades. So, you know, what am I going to do with that time? What am I going to leave behind me? And it, for me, it really came down to that I wanted to try to create things that might serve the communities that I'm a part of now,
yeah.
but that, you know, also with the hope that it might be God's good pleasure to use something of those things, you know, that would continue to have ripple effects that would extend well beyond
yeah.
my life. So
I think there are so many people listening who are young moms or who pastors or, and they don't want to write a book, but maybe make a family cookbook. Or I have a pillow in the room where I read and pray in the mornings that my mom sewed that has all the fruits of the Spirit on it and her initials in the year. You know, I just think, man, we all have this opportunity to create something that will outlast us, whether anyone outside of our family ever experiences it or not. It can take our faith and our experience in these decades and gift them to the next generation. I mean, I don't hardly know a person who doesn't have a copy of Every Moment Holy. So there's just something really profound about when the other things don't work, you put your heart to something new and God goes, that's the one that everybody can have. Does that feel true? Am I making that up?
No, it you know, I think the first printing of Volume 1, we printed 3,000 copies. And we released
it. Not very many, everyone.
Well, that was all Rabbit Room Press could afford.
Right, right. I mean, it's amazing.
So there was a Hutchmoot conference that was coming up at that time. So mm-hmm. so that was the first place the book was available.
Mm-hmm.
And they had been taking pre-orders. But the combination of the pre-orders and the Hutchmoot conference led to the book selling out within 2 weeks of
yes.
of it coming out, and we just did not anticipate that.
Right.
I mean, what we were thinking at that point was, okay, if this time next year, by the time we get to the next, it would have been that was Hutchmoot 2017 mm-hmm. when it came out. Mm-hmm. Hutchmoot 2018, if we're at the point where we need to reorder, then that'll be great.
And you did it in 2 weeks. Yeah.
So, yeah, we had no idea that there would be that kind of response. And we spent most of the first year just trying to get enough supply to meet the demand. I mean, we were going months at a time with nothing in stock because, you know, we couldn't get them printed.
Oh, I remember Andrew was in here and he asked me not to share about it until y'all had another order. And he was like, because I was saying, oh my gosh, I've just gotten this book that y'all made. It's unbelievable. And I was like, I just want to tell everybody. And he's like, hold on. Will you wait 2 weeks and then tell everyone, because we were waiting on an order. I mean, that it is just incredible what a gift it has been for the last 4 years. And now volume two, three, I identify as an Enneagram 7. Our show is called That Sounds Fun. And we're here talking about an entire book about death, grief, and hope. Everything is sad that you wrote.
Well, that's because I'm an Enneagram 4.
But we, you know, the thing about 7s and 4s is we look just the same as kids. We had a ton of feelings and we didn't know how to get them out. And so there's two paths when you have as many feelings as you and I have. So I think only someone who is as creative and as generous as a type 4 could do this kind of work, just so you know. I don't have what it takes to do this level of work. It doesn't exist in me. Why was volume 2, instead of fun, as I requested, why was volume 2 death, grief, and hope?
When I was writing volume 1, I had a list of potential topics. I had initially brainstormed, you know, several dozen topics when I pitched the idea.
How quick did you want to do two after you finished one?
I didn't really think about it for at least a year.
Okay.
Because it was a process. Writing volume one was a process that did take a toll.
I would imagine.
And so, yeah, I just had to step away from it.
Yes.
I felt pretty beat up.
Yes.
By the time I finished volume one. But I had this list, and we had opened up that conversation of what topics should be covered in the book, what mm-hmm. should we have prayers for. We had opened that up to various communities, mostly the Rabbit Room community mm-hmm. online. And people had given lots of great suggestions, many of which were in the book, and others were really good ones that ended up on the list. But mm-hmm. as we were approaching the deadline the last few months, before volume one manuscript had to go to the printer, I knew I wasn't going to be able to get to all of them, and the book couldn't be that long anyway. But there were certain ones that just felt very important. Mm-hmm. And one of them was a liturgy for grieving. Mm-hmm. For the idea was something for that immediate season of grief when you've lost someone. But I could just never reach the point of starting on that one. Hmm. You know, I think because that year was so chaotic and just writing the book was such an emotional process. And I was writing prayers that were about doubt and fear of failure and you know, for those who have not done great things for God, mm-hmm. that were forcing me to just kind of open up all my own insecurities and, you know, to go to some difficult places. And I just didn't have the emotional bandwidth, I think, to open that one up at that point and to approach it.
How kind to yourself. That is really kind to yourself.
Well, I probably made myself feel guilty about it. So I don't know how kind I was being, but.
Hey friends, just taking a short break from this conversation to give a shout out to our amazing partners, Thrive. Being a member of Thrive Market is one of my legit favorite things. It's an online membership-based market on a mission to make healthy living easy and affordable for everyone. I've been trying to get more protein in my diet, and they have these delicious beef snack sticks called Chomps that make an awesome protein-forward snack. And I can get them delivered along with all my pantry staples and non-toxic cleaning supplies. It is a win-win-win situation. Ordering from Thrive makes my very busy life a little bit easier, and I know it will for you too. With Thrive, you don't just get affordable, healthy foods and beauty products. You get the chance to give back through their Thrive Gives one-for-one matching program. Every paid membership sponsors a free one for a low-income family. I love that. Thrive has an amazing selection of high-quality, healthy foods, and they make it really easy to shop according to over 70 eating plans like keto or gluten-free. It's a one-stop shop for everything you need: organic groceries, clean beauty, safe supplements, and non-toxic home goods. Join Thrive Market today and get 25% off your first order and an exclusive free gift. The only way to get this offer is by going to thrivemarket.com/thatsoundsfun. That's T-H-R-I-V-E market.com/thatsoundsfun. Enjoy guaranteed savings and member-only prices. Thrive Market members save an average of $32 on every order. I saved enough on my last order to pay for the whole annual membership. You can't beat that. Thrive Market is good for you and the planet. Orders of $49 or more are shipped for free and delivered with carbon-neutral shipping from their zero-waste warehouses. Thrive Market now has two membership options: the one-month membership for $9.95 a month, or the 12-month membership for $5 a month, billed at $59.95. And an exclusive new offer for my friends. That's you. If you join today, you get 25% off your first order and an exclusive free gift. Again, that's thrivemarket.com/thatsoundsfun. And now back to finish our conversation with Doug McKelvey.
When Volume 1 came out, I knew that that was the biggest missing piece. That was the obvious gaping hole in the subject matter of the book, was that I hadn't offered anything for that. There was, the closest I had come to it was a liturgy for the anniversary of a loss.
Yes.
So I knew at some point I was going to try to write that one. But it took me a year to get to the point where I felt like, okay, I can go back into this, try to write some more prayers. I didn't actually write that one first. I think I wrote one related to, for a husband and wife, something like a liturgy for loving one man or woman well. But then I turned my attention to this topic of grieving and immediate loss. And I spent maybe a week and a half working on that prayer.
Oh, my gosh.
And it was 10 pages long, maybe, and just was obviously unwieldy. You know, I would read through it, and I kind of, you know, as the instinctive editing part of my brain was telling me, you know, this isn't working the way it is, but I would read through it, and I couldn't see anything that I could let go of.
Yeah.
So eventually I realized, okay, this must be more than one prayer. You know, I'm just trying to cover too much ground in one. So I went through and noted, okay, what are the main thematic threads or the main points that I'm covering here? And I think there were five or six. So I said, okay, I'll split it into a half dozen shorter prayers. So I did that, started working on each of those, trying to further refine them, and several of those were expanding rather than coming to completion. And then I thought, well, I'm writing these prayers for someone who's grieving. What about, I should probably write something for those who are going to minister to those who are grieving, who are just going to go mourn with those who mourn, to kind of create that space. So I wrote that one, and then I thought, well, what about someone who's dying? What about someone who gets that prognosis that they have 6 months to live? You know, for a follower of Jesus, what do they need in that season? Surely there are some prayers that could serve someone on that journey. At that point, I went back to Rabbit Room Press and I said, I think this is actually a book idea, but I think it's you know, it's topically focused, so I think we can make it shorter. It may be a third the length of volume one. We can do a smaller trim size and, sure. you know, and maybe 30 to 35 prayers. And they said, hey, that sounds great.
Dear everyone, spoiler alert, that's not what happened.
Yeah, so.
Wow.
You know, basically 2 years later, the project had just continued to expand, just all the different facets of grief. And yeah. as people heard that I was working on a volume of prayers mm-hmm. for this topic, mm-hmm. There were people who began to contact me
oh, wow.
who were going through things, who had just lost someone or who were in the process of dying, who were asking if I had, you know, I remember getting an email from someone who said, do you have anything you can send me now? Because I don't think I'll still be here by the time the book is published.
Yeah.
Wow. And, you know, there were other people just contacting me with, you know, just story after story of, you know, I lost my son 2 weeks ago to a high school football injury. Yeah. You know, can you send me right. something right. that might be helpful for the holidays mm-hmm. that are coming up? And then there were a handful of people who I had conversation. Well, not conversation. I mean, there were well over 150 people, probably closer to 200 that I had, you know, those kind of interactions with via email.
Oh my gosh. That is so heavy.
It was, but it wasn't a crushing kind of heaviness. I mean, you know, I would read those emails, and you know, often there would be tears, and I wanted to respond to. I didn't just want to give a generic response and attach, yeah. you know. Yeah. A prayer to it. I really wanted to respond to each of those people because they were telling me their stories.
Yeah.
And it was such a necessary part of the process of writing the book, I think, because I entered into it with some trepidation and just a sense of, I'm not really qualified to write a lot of these prayers, mm. especially ones for things like the loss of a child.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, my wife and I have had a couple of miscarriages, so yeah, I was comfortable writing one for miscarriages, but you know, I know people who have lost children mm-hmm. a few years old, and you know, it felt presumptuous to think that, oh, I can,
oh,
you know,
I
can articulate
yes,
what's
yes,
on
yes,
the heart of that person. So I knew that if this book was actually going to be of service to people who are going through these things, mm-hmm. that it would have to be written with the voices of those who have gone through those things, who
yeah.
were going through those things, weighing in. Mm. on it and shaping it, and that I had to find people who would be willing to open up a window
yeah.
to their own grief.
Sure.
And who would be willing to be very honest and just tell me when I was getting it wrong, mm-hmm. you know, that I could send these prayers to them and get their feedback.
Wow.
And you know, that they would be gracious to tell me what I was missing or mm-hmm. where the tone didn't fit with their experience. So there were several people that I would kind of put in the core group
yeah.
category who really were willing to get down in the weeds of mm-hmm. of some of these with me. And there was a woman, Amy, who had just lost her husband and her 7 and 9-year-old daughters,
oh,
who got in touch with me within a couple weeks of that having happened, and we began to correspond, and for a year she was just giving me, you know, such precious insight into what she was walking through week by week in that process. And there's so much in the book that that wouldn't serve people in the way that I think it will now if it weren't for her willingness and the willingness of a few other people who did similar kinds of things with specific topics that, that related to what their own grief journey was.
What happens to you after you write this book? What has it been like to be deep into this?
Well, it, you know, through the process, there were people checking in on me, some of the people at Rabbit Room Press, who seemed to think that it would be this soul-crushing dark cloud kind of thing. And it wasn't that.
You're like, yo, I'm a four. It's my life.
Well, with volume one, volume one took a year to write, and it was a chaotic year, and it kind of felt like the wheels were just coming off of my life in, you know, in lots of different ways. In addition to, there were some good things going on, like two of my daughters got married that summer, and my youngest daughter was transitioning from high school to college. But even those good things were creating chaos and stress.
I mean, two weddings in one summer of girls is no joke.
Yeah. So by the time I got to the finish line of volume one, I had nothing left, and I just kind of stumbled across the finish line, and I didn't care what happened to the book. I was just emotionally numb to it. But as soon as I finished the manuscript, as soon as the work was done, there was this massive just sort of bounce back to life, feeling easy and okay, and everything that had been tough was pretty good again. And with volume two and the 2 year process of writing that, it wasn't the same kind of chaotic season. It didn't feel like, you know, every part of my life was a fight. But there was this steady accumulation of gravity. You know, there was this slow, gradual taking on of a burden that I think is just part of being willing to enter the grief of other people. And it's something that's as it should be. You know, it's not, there was no bounce back when I finished this book. It just kind of continued. And I realized, well, I think that's, you know, there's a passage in the Old Testament where the different families, clans of the Israelites are receiving their assignments from Moses. And, you know, the ones who carry the different parts of the temple as they're traveling. And you know, so this family carries the curtains and, you know, all these things on, and they have wagons to, or carts to do that. But then he comes to the Kohathites, if I'm pronouncing that right. And they are the ones who are going to carry the most holy things, like from the Holy of Holies thing. And they're given no carts to carry these. These burdens they must carry on their shoulders. And that many years ago, when I kind of really pondered that passage for the first time, I thought there's something in there that is analogous to some of the kinds of burdens that we carry in our lives, right? That there are some that we kind of have a buffer from and things that make them easier. And then there are others that we feel more, that shape us, mm-hmm. you know? And maybe it's sometimes because those are these holy things in our lives that it's right that it costs something and I don't want to make my own role in the process sound like I think it's grandiose or something, because I think my main job with these books, my main role is just to get out of their way. I felt like that the whole time. I don't, you know, if I write a work of fiction, I kind of feel like, hey, I did that.
That's my story.
Yeah, with these books, I feel like through the whole process, the only thing I did was not say no. As much as I wanted to say no and quit writing them at so many points along the way for so many reasons. But really, that's all I brought to it, was I just kept showing up. If not every day, every few days at least, I would bring myself to the table again and say, okay, I'll try to be faithful with whatever's in front of me today to do. So, but there are griefs that we carry, that there is this holiness to them, right? And that it's, I mean, when you love someone and you lose them, that grief is an ongoing work of the love, mm-hmm. right? And the willingness to bear the wounds of love. So I think through the process of writing this book, and specifically through having people who were carrying such deep and heavy griefs walking alongside me and speaking into this, that I was learning a little bit of what it means to mourn with those who mourn, mm-hmm. and to grieve with them, and to try to enter some of those spaces in a secondhand kind of way, but to better understand that I might articulate what was on their hearts and what they were feeling and thinking, and what the outpouring of their hearts to God might look like. So I think those people, you know, are bearing those most holy kind of burdens, mm-hmm. like the Kohathites. And it was my honor to be able to walk beside them and, you know, and through this book, maybe to be able to, if not to ease those burdens for people, mm-hmm. at least to give them language that in those moments of deep emotion, you might not have access to, right? Because grief, deep grief, isn't always something that leaves us in a place where we can think clearly.
Yes.
So the idea of having these prayers that do, that were crafted with the input of people who are experiencing grief, but those thoughts, those heart cries, crafted and recorded in such a way that other people who will walk those same paths might be able to open the book and find the comfort of being able to, through these words, through these prayers, to articulate what they might not have even been able to name yet.
Yes.
In terms of
once they can find the title matching, the words will be such a gift to, I didn't even, that is exactly how I want to say that, and I didn't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. The cover of Every Moment Holy, Volume 2, is right in front of me. The clock reads 11:51, maybe, 11:52. Do you know, does it exactly read one or the other? Do you know?
I don't know. That's one of the secrets that the mysterious Ned Bustard, who yes. illustrated the book and designed the cover.
What time's the original? What time's the Every Moment Holy original cover say?
I don't know.
I don't know either. And
people have tried to find significance in that one, but Ned has said it's just the idea of just sort of a random time. It's not a time with specific significance. It's an every moment. You know, it could be any
moment. I believe you, Doug, but I will not be surprised if in 10 years, when there's a few more volumes, you go like, okay, here's how all the times make sense. Because in Rabbit Room world, everything matters. Every drawing, everything. Y'all are sneaky like that.
Well, in this case, it would be Ned who's sneaky. So yes, it wouldn't surprise me either. But so far, right. he's not telling us if he's attached some significance to that.
Well, it's the work you do is such a gift. I just can't. I feel so honored that you would even sit down and chat with me about it because it has mattered deeply to me. The original version, the original volume, this volume, both matter significantly to me. Is there anything we didn't talk about that you want to make sure we cover?
I don't think so.
Okay. Do you know the last question we always ask? It's going to be a pretty good right turn for you or left turn for you, whichever way you enjoy more. Because the show is called That Sounds Fun, tell me what sounds fun to you. What do you guys do for fun?
You know, I am so ready to travel.
Yes. Where do you want to go?
2 years ago, I got to spend a couple of weeks traipsing through the Scottish Highlands.
Mm. I used to live there. Do you know that?
No.
I used to live in Edinburgh.
Really?
So you are speaking my love language.
Yeah. Yeah. And I also got to go with my wife to Northern Ireland, mm-hmm. and we spent some time in Dublin as well on that trip. And I love that part of the world, yeah. but the Highlands in particular. Oh. It's just I don't know that I've ever been anywhere where the landscape has that kind of just wonder-inducing aura to it.
Yes,
and. The scenery is so spectacular and beautiful, but the atmosphere, the clouds, the water, the rocks, the hills, the fields, the waterfalls and, mm-hmm. and creeks and rivers.
The green. It's just not it's not a shade you can describe.
Yeah. Yeah. And you see the most gorgeous panorama you've ever seen, mm-hmm. and you pull your car over and, enjoy it and take a couple photos. And then you drive 100 yards further over
right.
the hill, and it's like, oh.
I know.
Completely different world, wonderful.
Yes.
In an entirely other way. And, yeah, I really want to explore more of the western coast of the Highlands mm-hmm. and the Isle of Skye.
Yes.
I haven't been to the Isle of Skye.
I haven't either.
Yet, but.
I'm going to say some things to you so that if you ever want to go back and listen to remember these next time you go, there's as you're going up from Edinburgh, there's a lake called Loch Tay. There's a place there called Borland where you can stay, and it kind of is a good home base when you go up into the Highlands. And then there's an inn and a restaurant called Ballantagert that is unbelievable.
Okay.
It's unbelievable. It is everything you want in like a beautiful Highlands experience, but not in a touristy way. And like this is exactly what I thought would be tucked right here.
Except that now that you've announced it on your show
right.
with as many listeners as you have,
right.
it's just going to become a tourist
well,
trap.
That's right. You and I, our families will get there first and get our chances. So, but I am so with you. I was teary this weekend wanting to go to Scotland. I am just ready. That is just one of my very favorite places. So that sounds fun to me too. Thank you for being on the show today.
Sure.
I really appreciate it. I can't wait for people to get this volume of Every Moment Holy. Oh, you guys, isn't he the best? My gracious. I'm so thankful for his thoughts and his words. And I love anytime someone lets me talk about Scotland for a few minutes. So be sure to grab a copy of Every Moment Holy, Volume 2, Death, Grief, and Hope. And go follow Doug so you can tell him thanks for being on the show today. If you need anything else from me, I'm embarrassingly easy to find. Annie F. Downs on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, wherever you may need me. That is how you can find me. And I'm Annie F. Downs, TSF, like That Sounds Fun, on YouTube. And I think that's it for me today, friends. go out or stay home. Do something that sounds fun to you. I will do the same. Have a great weekend. Get some rest. And we'll see you back here on Monday with Ben Kirby, also known as Preachers and Sneakers. See y'all Monday.
Well, good day to you. It's Joel with the King Country dropping in to let you know that our brand new film, Unsung Hero, is in theaters now.
It's Luke here. We've teamed up with the creators of Jesus Revolution to bring you this adventure of a lifetime. It's a powerful, true story about a family uniting, growing in their faith, and facing the impossible together.
In theaters now, unsunghero.movie for more information.
Rated PG. Parental guidance suggested.